It is Thursday, December 24th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. In the next half hour, Beijing responds to an unprecedented security threat against Westerners. We'll get the latest from a journalist based in the Chinese capital. We'll ask an expert whether a new UN Security Council resolution on Libya can really help to end years of conflict that have split the country. And we'll take you to a Christmas village in a rural Pennsylvania town in the northeastern U.S. It's all ahead on International Edition. The U.S. Embassy in Beijing has issued an unusual warning to its citizens of a Christmastime security threat against Westerners in one of the city's most popular expatriate districts. Beijing authorities deployed armed security personnel to the Sanlitun shopping area in response to the threat. The British, French, and Irish embassies sent out similar security warnings, but none of the foreign diplomatic missions gave any further details about the nature of the threat. Well, for more on the situation in Beijing, I spoke on the phone a short time ago to the editor of the magazine Time Out Beijing, Lee Williamson. I asked him what the scenes were like on the streets of central Beijing.
Well, in Beijing, Sanlitun, it's an awful lot quieter than it was Christmas Eve last year. I can tell you that. I was on the streets in 2014, Christmas Eve, doing a bit of last-minute shopping. It was very bustling. The ATMs had run out of cash. It was full of both expatriates and native Chinese doing Christmas shopping. And this year was a bit of a different scenario. It was certainly not deathly quiet. Beijing is never deathly quiet, but there were far fewer people on the streets today than there would be ordinarily.
And what do you attribute that to?
Well, I mean, I can't speak for other people, but I assume it has to be the warnings that were issued by the U.S. State Department and by the British embassy as well, telling people that there was some security threats and they advising people to be cautious and to stay away from the area. It must be down to that, really. That's certainly why a lot of people didn't go to Sanlitun today that I know personally.
Well, how does this security threat compare to anything that you've seen before in Beijing?
Well, certainly I can't remember the last couple of years there being an incident like this where there was a warning related to security that was issued before an incident that was also very, very vague. Well, no one really knows exactly what the threat is. It doesn't really compare to anything we've had recently. Usually the State Department and such give pollution warnings. The last major warning that was given out was about acid rain after the Tianjin explosions earlier this year. But a warning like this related to a security threat is, as far as I know, in the last few years at least, it hasn't happened.
Well, I want to get to the smog situation in just a moment, but what kind of presence of security forces did we see in Beijing today?
So in the Sanlitun area, which is where people were advised to avoid today, there were what appeared to be military police, certainly heavily armed police, certainly heavily armed, I should say. I'm not sure if they're military police or civilian police, but heavily armed guards with machine guns and armored vehicles throughout Sanlitun, and also very heavy-duty roadblocks as well, blocking certain key alleyways in the Sanlitun shopping area. A lot of armed guards and not so many pedestrians.
I understand a lot of people are taking pictures of them as well, is that right?
Yeah, I mean, for sure. I don't know how much of a storm in a teacup this is. I hope it turns out to be, a big lot of hot air over nothing and there is no eventual security breach. But it seemed like a lot of hot air today because there were maybe 10 or so that I saw, a dozen or so guards on the streets, whereas everybody knew they were there, and there were dozens and dozens of people taking selfies in front of the police and taking pictures of the guard and everything like that.
Well, speaking of the air, how bad was the smog today?
The air has actually been fine today. There was a couple of hours when it wasn't. By I should add the caveat, by Beijing standards, it's been pretty good. I think the AQI is hovering around about 100 today, which, while in a lot of cities in the West that would come with warnings, and because they're quite high in Beijing, it's a fairly average day. So the red alert has been issued, but a red alert doesn't necessarily mean that the smog is at a certain level. I believe a red alert means that they anticipate that the air quality index will be 200 or above for a few days in a row. I'm not entirely sure about that. I'm no expert on air quality. Because they've issued a red alert doesn't necessarily mean that the air is particularly bad today. They're just saying that it's going to be bad today and over the next couple of days. So currently the air is absolutely fine, but we're all staying at home with air purifiers ready, waiting for it to get worse.
Okay, well, I hope the air doesn't get as bad as is feared. But thanks very much to Time Out Beijing magazine editor Lee Williamson for speaking to International Edition.
Okay, thank you.
Well, it's time for a look at social media and what they're saying about the Beijing security threat. Actually, you can see a tweet from Lee Williamson of a photo that he took of people taking pictures of the armed police in Beijing. You can follow Lee at LeeSW1985. He tweeted, "Lots of armed police in Sanlitun streets, but nothing compared to the number of people taking pics of the said police." You can also see a tweet from a Beijing correspondent for The Guardian newspaper, Tom Phillips. His handle is at TomPhillipsIN, and he said, "Never seen rifle-toting armed forces in Taikuli before," and you can see another one of his pictures also. And then there's this tweet from a Twitter user named Steven, whose handle is at LordSpuggy. He asked, "So what's the threat against Westerners in Beijing all about, and where is it coming from? I hope this isn't more Uyghur bashing." And that's a reference to the fact that Chinese authorities have blamed members of the country's mostly Muslim Uyghur minority for violent acts of terror in the past. But of course, there's no information at the moment officially about where this threat is coming from. Well, if you want to follow this show on Twitter, you can find us at VOA_IE. And you can find me at Michael_Lippin. This is VOA.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
One of the world's great cities, the gateway to America for generations. VOA brings you New York in 12 rarely seen views, presenting the 2016 VOA calendar, a gift from us, free for the asking. Just send us your mailing address in an email to calendar@voanews.com, and you can have New York's beauty grace your wall all next year.
I'm Michael Lippin with VOA's International Edition. The UN Security Council has unanimously adopted a Libya resolution backing last week's signing of a UN-brokered national unity agreement for the North African nation. The resolution adopted on Wednesday urged members of Libya's rival administrations to implement that unity deal within 30 days. Well, the University of San Francisco Middle East analyst Stephen Zunes told VOA's Victor Beatty via Skype that while Security Council action is welcome, Zunes said it is no guarantee to bring peace and stability to the country.
The problem, of course, is that even if you have the two quasi-government entities together, you still have hundreds of thousands of Libyans under arms that are part of militia. Some are allied with one half of this government, some are allied with the other half, but quite a few are not allied with either.
The council is urging Libya to form a unity government within 30 days. Is that going to be possible?
It's quite possible that they could work out some kind of government coalition. However, will they be an actually unified government, or will they essentially govern the areas of Libya they currently control jointly, with only a facade of some kind of broader governing structure? The other question, I think, is whether Libyan people themselves are happy with the arrangement. Remember, the Libyans, in their free election right after the fall of Gaddafi, but before things fell apart in these armed conflicts, voted for a moderate government, but seemed to be very much interested in democracy. And it was a grassroots, initially nonviolent struggle that started the uprising, that later turned violent and ended up ousting Gaddafi. So there is civil society to contend with. And while civil society has been traditionally weak in that country, the real question is whether the government will listen to the Libyan people and not just the men with guns.
The speakers of both rival governments have rejected this deal. Is there a possibility that this will be scotched even before it gets underway?
That is quite possible. It could also mean that they're just posturing, trying to hold out for getting a bigger piece of the pie as they divide things up. And this may be the biggest problem. In the past few years, when it's been ruled by various armed factions, people have lost the art of compromise. You know, whether the lack of unity the country's had in recent years and most of the country's rule on since independence, either being under authoritarian monarch or under Gaddafi, there's not much experience in the kind of give and take that's necessary to compromise with one's rivals.
That was Stephen Zunes of the University of San Francisco, speaking with International Edition's Victor Beatty. An unexpected drop in U.S. crude oil inventories or supplies gave a slight boost to the price of oil on Wednesday to $36.77 a barrel. But oil prices remain close to 10-year lows due to a number of factors, including the strong value of the U.S. dollar and slowing global demand. While falling oil prices have proved to be a godsend for consumers, they're also hurting oil-producing countries, as we hear in this report from VOA's Mil Arcega.
Oil prices haven't been this low in more than 10 years. Average U.S. gasoline prices are now below 53 cents per liter, an early Christmas present for motorists.
I remember 1 year ago, I had to put around $50. Now, maybe with 36 or $38, I fill it up my car.
It amounts to a $115 billion boost to the U.S. economy, or a yearly savings of $555 for every motorist, says AAA spokesman Robert Sinclair.
And we think that's something that's going to continue. Plenty of crude oil supplies still remain. Crude oil futures are pointing to even lower prices as we're going forward in the next month or so. So we could see prices drop another 25, 30 cents in the next month.
For oil-producing countries, the price declines have been a lose-lose proposition, according to economist C. Fred Bergsten on VOA's Hashtag VOA program.
The Russians lose, the Saudis lose, the Venezuelans lose, U.S. oil shale producers lose, but that is more than offset by the net reduction in consumer costs.
Because most commodities are priced in U.S. dollars, some blame the higher exchange rate for price declines. But New York analyst Peter Cardillo says it's just supply and demand.
If you have lower demand on a global scale, and then you have overproduction from producing nations, it's obviously that you're going to have a crash in oil prices, and that's exactly what's happened.
But it's a price plunge with serious geopolitical consequences. A case in point, says Bergsten, is Russia.
5 to 10 years ago, when oil prices were very high, Putin was riding high. Now, with the energy price having collapsed as much as it has, he's had to pursue foreign adventures, Ukraine, now Syria, other things, to try to divert his whole population's attention from their very poor economic circumstances, driven in large part by the collapse of oil prices.
Oil prices are not likely to rise anytime soon. New projections from both the World Bank and International Monetary Fund suggest prices will fall further to as low as $20 a barrel in 2016. Mil Arcega, VOA News, Washington.
This is VOA.
Here's science in a minute.
NASA's Curiosity Mars rover gave scientists a big surprise. As they reviewed data gathered by the Mars rover, scientists found that some rocks in Gale Crater contain the chemical compound silica. In fact, they say it's a very high amount of the compound. According to the researchers, silica is actually a combination of silicon and oxygen. On Earth, we normally see the compound as quartz, but it can also be found in a number of other minerals. Albert Yen, a Curiosity science team member at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, says two geological processes that can increase the concentration of silica involves water. Knowing which of the two processes took place will allow scientists to learn more about the ancient wet environments of Mars. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition with me, Michael Lippin. What began as an American farmer decorating his Pennsylvania home with lights more than 60 years ago has turned into a seasonal Christmas village for visitors. The Cozier family's Christmas village is now a major tourist attraction with dazzling lights and old-fashioned toys. VOA's Deborah Block had a walk around the village's more than 1 million lights, as she tells us in this report.
During the holiday season, this one-time dairy farm becomes a make-believe Christmas village. It began in 1948 when William Cozier decorated his family's 19th-century house with Christmas lights and decorations.
And people just heard about it, saw it just locally, and then they spread the word, and they just started to come and line up on the hill, and they would wait for the lights to go on.
Then, says Beverly Cozier, her father put lights on the barn.
He decorated the big silo, and he would put things in the windows here in the barn. And at the same time, we still had 40 cows being milked.
Each year, he added more light displays and then small village buildings. The farm became a seasonal paid attraction.
He just really, really enjoyed people coming and telling him how it made the Christmas season so much more meaningful to them.
After her father died about 30 years ago, Beverly Cozier and other family members kept the Christmas village alive.
There are lots of our toys. We have my mother's china.
Hundreds of thousands of people visit during the 2 months it is open during the holiday season. Cozier says this bell and wishing well have been on the farm since she was a little girl.
And everybody comes here, rings the bell, throws their money in, and it goes to charity.
Some people came when they were a child. Now they bring their own children, who also enjoy the displays. Even the Christmas Village Santa says he looks forward to the dazzling lights.
They're so beautiful. It lights the whole valley up. And it just brings joy to so many people.
The Cozier children follow their father's tradition by adding new features, like this year's more modern Christmas tree light display. But Beverly Cozier says the idea is to keep the village much the way it used to be.
We keep it as nostalgic as we can. To this day, we still enjoy seeing people have so much fun here.
Deborah Block, VOA News, Burnville, Pennsylvania.
And to end our show today, we have a little something about the music of the holiday season with International Edition's Steve Norman.
Feliz Navidad. Feliz Navidad. Feliz Navidad. Prospero año y felicidad. I want to wish you a Merry Christmas. I want to wish you a Merry Christmas. I want to wish you a Merry Christmas from the bottom of my heart. I want to wish you a Merry Christmas. I want to wish you a Merry Christmas. I want to wish you a Merry Christmas from the bottom of my heart.
Music is a big part of the holiday tradition. And singer-songwriter Jose Feliciano's Feliz Navidad is one of the most popular new Christmas classics.
Ha-ha! Feliz Navidad. Feliz Navidad. Feliz Navidad. Prospero año y felicidad.
At a point when his career had been sagging for some time, Feliciano wrote Feliz Navidad. That was in 1970, and even today it gets tens of thousands of downloads every Christmas.
I don't want a lot for Christmas. There is just one thing I need. I don't care about the presents underneath the Christmas tree. I just want you for my own. My wish come true. All I want
1994, singer Mariah Carey and composer Walter Afanasieff wrote All I Want for Christmas Is You, and the world had a new Christmas classic. Those who celebrate Christmas, almost all of them love the traditional songs such as Silent Night and Joy to the World. But they also embrace, in a major way, the new classics, one of which came from Bob Wells and Mel Torme, who in 1945 wrote what quickly became one of the most popular holiday songs of all times, simply titled The Christmas Song, sung here by Aaron Neville.
Chestnuts roasting on an open fire, Jack Frost nipping at your nose, Yuletide carols being sung by a choir, and folk dressed up like Eskimos. Everybody knows a turkey and some mistletoe help to make the season bright.
Well, my thanks to Steve Norman for putting together that great Christmas medley. You've been listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. The show was brought to you by director Patrice Martin, and the engineer was Pete Hunley. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. You can find me on Twitter at Michael_Lippin. And this show is there, too. We are at VOA_IE. For all of those celebrating, have a Merry Christmas.
He's loaded lots of toys and goodies on his...
Next, an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.
In a popular American short story, a young couple, poor but very much in love, frets over what to give each other for Christmas. To buy her husband Jim a chain for his proudest possession, a gold pocket watch, Della sells her proudest possession, her long brown hair, to be made into a wig. Jim finds Della a fine pair of hair combs, but he can pay for them only by trading away his watch. When they exchange gifts and realize what they've done, their now useless presents are all the more precious because of the love and sacrifice they represent. The holiday of Christmas, which millions of Americans and others around the world celebrate today, has inspired many such tales. Some deal with the lessons of generosity and hope, others with the value of friendship, family, and faith. Oddly, one of the most famous, A Christmas Carol by Charles Dickens, is essentially a ghost story. What they have in common is a spirit of redemption and rejoicing that has long touched the human heart. Tradition is as much a part of the holiday as is its spirit. As in much of the world, millions of Americans will exchange gifts, worship together in their various ways, then gather perhaps with family and friends to complete the celebration over dinner. Many will volunteer to help the homeless, hungry, and others in need. These sentiments transcend nationality, however, and even religion. As the world gets smaller, the Christmas spirit is seen in many places, from Europe to Africa and even Asia. In Japan, Christmas is known more as a time to spread happiness rather than as a religious celebration. Presents and cards are exchanged, and parties are often held for children, with games and dancing. In Madagascar, an island nation off the east coast of Africa, it's summer at Christmas time. But even though it's hot, many homes are decorated in the spirit of the season with holly and imitation snow, even though none of them exist there. The message of peace on earth and goodwill toward men is universal, and one that Americans wish to share at this time of year with all citizens of the world.
That was an editorial.